Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 51st symphony season of the Livermore Amador Symphony. And this golden anniversary plus one is also the golden anniversary of Maestro Art Barnes. Give it up for him. So we are continuing our golden tradition this year, as we did last year. So expect lots of surprises and lots of high-quality music like you are used to receiving. So we have a wonderful program for you tonight, and there are three of us who are going to speak. The soloist, Joyce Hamilton, is going to speak about the trumpet concerto, and I'm going to start off with just a few words about the Beethoven Symphony No. 2. And we will start off tonight with that. Beethoven wrote this piece during his early period, as it is called. Scholars divide his career into three periods, generally marked by the type of music that he wrote and also his personal circumstance. And he wrote this symphony in 1802, in the time that he was staying at Heiligenstadt, which is a city in Austria. And the name Heiligenstadt means the holy city. And to this day, no one knows why. But that's the name of it, and Beethoven stayed there. And the reason this is important is because he wrote his famous Heiligenstadt Memorandum Manifesto, which was his declaration that he was at a point in his life where he felt that he had done everything he could do. And he was done performing, he was done composing. Mind you, he had written only one of his nine symphonies. But he was quite depressed, and he was also beginning to lose his hearing at this point. And so he wrote this famous manifesto, and he says, "I cannot do this anymore, but I will persist for the sake of my art." And he left Heiligenstadt. He then went back to Vienna and finished the Second Symphony, and it was actually a great success, although not initially. And the one thing I want to point out about this particular symphony is that it is the first time in the classical tradition that a scherzo shows up as a movement. And you may have heard me speak in the past about scherzos. The word is Italian, and it means musical joke. And a lot of people use the term scherzo to refer to some kind of internal humor, but they never really say what it is. And so, in the third movement of the Second Symphony, it's a triple meter piece. It's kind of like a minuet. And what Beethoven is doing in this piece is he's taking this song form, and he is doing a number of things to it that are designed to upset the people who are going to hear it. He is being satirical. And what he does is he takes the melody, which goes something like this. It goes, dun, da 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 da. And he accents those notes right before the first beat of the next measure. And the imitation that he's going for is a side-slapping Austrian dance. And he knows that he's writing this music for the aristocracy, so that's why he wants to imitate a Munich beer hall instead of an aristocratic tea party. So he plays the piece, he performs it, and as I said earlier, it was received with mixed reviews. And I found an interesting quote that I think is quite indicative of the way that people hear music and then interpret it in their own special way. And this was the review that came out the week after the debut of the Second Symphony, and the writer had this to say. The Second Symphony is, quote, "a hideously writhing, wounded dragon that refuses to die, but writhing in its last agonies and, in the fourth movement, bleeding to death." So, needless to say, critics of later generations were not quite so sanguine, and Symphony No. 2 is a well-loved piece. So I will pass it over to Dr. Art Barnes, and he will tell you more.
Our Benjamin Lease Concerto for Woodwind Quintet and Orchestra. We did this 25 years ago, and I hunted around for a recording, and no recording at Stanford. I asked the B&H, who's in Hawks, where we're renting the music. They have no recording. And in the process of looking for a cassette tape of my trumpet concerto, which Joyce wanted to refer to, I came across this taped recording of the Benjamin Lease. And I thought, boy, that was 25 years ago. And I've got the tape. And I play it. It's not us at all. It's the Cleveland Orchestra with Lauren Monsell playing this concerto. And how I got hold of the tape, I have no idea. The interesting thing about this is a piece that's 15 minutes long. It's all of one piece. That is, it doesn't start and stop three times, three different movements. But you'll see sections. It's a small orchestra, relatively, in that the Woodwind Quintet is composed of the principal. He wrote it with the idea of you don't have to go out and hire people to play it. You just use the principal players in your orchestra, principal flute, oboe, clarinet, bassoon, and French horn, which is the standard Woodwind Quintet. And with that coloration of those winds, he decided it's going to be too competitive, so I won't use any of the woodwinds at all that are left in the orchestra. And I will use two trumpets, two French horns, and three trombones for background gestures, especially when the orchestra plays and everybody plays all together. Now, a concerto is a fight. To concertare means to do battle with. Well, that's a little strong for this case, but at least what you're going to hear is the quintet all by itself without anybody else playing, the orchestra without the quintet playing, and parts of the music when everybody's playing together. So he has that form of layout. And the other thing that's interesting, if you get bored at all, there's going to be two large sections, one in the middle and one toward the end, that we would treat as cadenzas. So for the first time you hear, each one of the soloists will be playing a little cadenza. And then we go on to play some more music. And back toward the end, you're going to hear boom, 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 boom. This beat, this constant 4-4 time beat. It's one of the few times when that's a large section, of 4-4 time. And each player will expose themselves musically. And then it's over after 15 minutes. He wrote also many other kinds of music. He also wrote for a string quartet and orchestra. So this piece is not well known. He is a San Francisco person, but he spent most of his musical life on the East Coast, and on the East Coast he's more well known. He does not get played out here. He should. The last time he played it, his brother was in San Francisco, and between him and his brother, they constructed the program notes along with Josh Cohen, who used to play in the orchestra. The program notes that you have in your program right now. Now, we're going to listen to something that Joyce has to say. And she has all her artillery there.
Thank you. Well, it was a surprise to be invited to do a reprise of Art's concerto after, 20 or 30 years. And boy, we had to do some digging. I had to find the trumpet part and get a complete part. I had a page here and a page there. But it's a fun piece to play, and a really great concerto. It would be especially great on a Pops concert. This is sort of a mixed program, starting with Beethoven, ending with Gershwin. So it fits very nicely. Very challenging for the trumpet. But you see, I walked out here tonight with three trumpets, and that's why he asked me to say a few words. Because as I was practicing during the summer and thinking about the piece, I thought, whoa, this second movement would really sound great on the flugelhorn. So I got my flugelhorn out, and sure enough, it sounded just fine. And so then I was working on the last movement, and I thought, gee, this would really sound great on the E-flat cornet. I wonder if it would fit. And I'll tell you about these instruments. First of all, this is, if you know someone who plays a trumpet, this is probably the kind of trumpet they play, the size of trumpet, and has three valves. This mouthpiece looks a little bit strange because it's a Monette mouthpiece. These are very, very expensive mouthpieces, so I look for them on eBay, don't you know? And if I can find one under $110, I might get it. But it turned out the first movement of the piece is a little bit Spanishy and requires some really hot, clear single tonguing, like. So you can see how, and I've picked up this mouthpiece one day. I thought, I bet I could make that sound better on another mouthpiece. All trumpet players think that, so that's why. And a trumpet is just a whole bunch of bugles that they finally figured out how to get into one instrument. Because if you could only play, no, you're in the military for one thing. And that was certainly the purpose for trumpets. But they could, people who knew about things could see that if you could do this, if you could add another length of tubing, and each time we press down a key, that instrument gets a little bit longer, so. Seven different valve combinations, seven different bugles, all combined into one instrument. It was like heaven to finally come up with an instrument that could play a whole scale using all those different bugles. So that's the story of the trumpet. Now, the story of these different size trumpets. A cornet, you've probably heard of trumpets and cornets. The trumpet was essentially a cylindrical instrument, cylindrical tubing, cylindrical, cylindrical, all the way to the flare of the bell. And a cylindrical tubing gets a really bright sound. So a conical tubing, the cornet traditionally is an instrument with conical tubing. That means that the mouthpiece is smaller where the instrument, where the mouthpiece goes into the horn, and it gets steadily bigger, and the bore, the size of the instrument, gets steadily bigger, just in the way of a cone. And the flugelhorn is also a conical instrument, so it has a receiver almost the size of the cornet. But you can see it gets even a bigger bell, so it is like super, super mellow. The more conical instrument is a little bit more mellow sound, and you see in the French horn of the orchestra, it's a much mellower sound than the trumpet. It has a very small receiver for the mouthpiece, very, very big bell. I'll let you hear these instruments here. This is not quite as mellow because it is a high soprano instrument. But one feature that you get with melodic instruments, with mellow sounding instruments and conical instruments, is a nice ability to play very floridly. So we have these kind of passages. So there's a lot of that going trumpet part for this horn, and changing it to E flat is that the B flat trumpet often goes way down lower than the E flat can play, but this particular movement fits perfectly. Thank you.
Thank you, Joyce.
I should tell you about why I wrote this. At the time, and even now, Joyce is a trumpet teacher at Stanford, and I was having a band concert, and I said, let's have Joyce play a, what we call an old-timey silver cornet spit and polish cornet solo, like you might hear if you heard John Philip Sousa band or Arthur Pryor's band. And she said, well, I don't think I want to play Bride of the Waves anymore or those things. Why don't you write me something? So I wrote her a piece, this piece that she's going to play, and it's one of the few things I've written where I sat down and just started writing, and everything just sort of flowed. The trumpet would play for 4 bars or 8 bars, then the band would play for 4 bars or 8 bars, and pretty soon it was over. That was the first movement. Then we have a song movement, the second movement, and that was nice. It had some nice, juicy harmony chords, and then a rousing one at the end, the third movement, which you just heard the beginning of. That's nice. But I must say that the other times we performed it, you and I, we have used the trumpet with a cup mute in it, which produces a much different sound. But the sound of the flugelhorn is lovely, which I hadn't thought of it that way. But initially she just did all 3 movements on a B-flat trumpet. But the idea of using a cornet is just fine. And I think this is going to be recorded, so get all the notes, will you?
And finally, we will close with George Gershwin's American in Paris. And his story is that he was very talented as a pianist and also as a composer. And before he became famous for the music that he wrote, he was what was called a song slugger, I think was the term. And this was in New York City in the 1920s. And a song plugger, thank you. And see, I learn all the time as well. And what a song plugger does or did was he was a pianist who was hired by a music publisher to sit in the showroom of the music publishing house and play whatever music was placed in front of him. So if you were a person who was looking for sheet music for your band, you might have been an orchestra conductor, or more likely you were a band leader, or you may have just been a club owner who was looking for music to give your house pianist, you would go to a music publisher and you would look over the music, and if you could sing it or hear it in your mind, that was fine, but if you actually wanted someone to play it for you, you would hand it to the song plugger, and then they would actually wheel it up to the second floor, put it in front of the pianist, and he would play it for you. It was kind of an automatic human jukebox. And the song pluggers in the 1920s actually made a lot of money. Many of them made $30,000 or $40,000 a year, which in 1920 is like $300,000 or $400,000. They were all unionized. They could all do whatever they wanted to. And most of them, of course, also played in bands because they were naturally musicians. So his background was this whole Tin Pan Alley culture. And Tin Pan Alley is the term that was used for all the music publishing houses in New York City in the 1920s. And it was called that because all of the publishers had these song pluggers in the second and third floors of their buildings, and usually the windows would be open, and you would walk down West 28th Street in New York City between 5th and 6th Avenue, and you would hear all these pianos coming out of all the buildings. And it sounded like clanking tin pans, and that's where the name comes from. So Gershwin first achieved fame with The Rhapsody in Blue, and once that was happening, he was invited to play and to compose by a lot of people. He actually met Maurice Ravel at one point when Ravel came to New York City and asked whether he could study under Ravel. And Ravel heard his music and said, you know, it is better to be a first-rate Gershwin than a second-rate Ravel. High compliment from a great composer. Gershwin spent some time in Paris in 1926, 1927. And this was during the time when all the American expatriate writers were living in Paris. So you had Ernest Hemingway, and you had Ezra Pound, and you know, people like Pablo Picasso. We don't know if Gershwin actually met any of these people, but that was the ferment that he was writing out of. And so the American in Paris, and American in Paris, is actually a tone poem. Is that? That is a picture written in sound. So as a poem using words evokes imagery from the meaning and the sound of the words, a tone poem in music does exactly the same thing with notes. So what Gershwin is doing in this piece is he's walking down the Champs-Élysées and he is hearing all of the sounds of Paris, including the taxi horns. And if you're in Paris, even to this day, they will drive by and honk at you because they're looking for fares. And so Gershwin actually writes these sounds into the music. And what he's creating is a picture, both, you know, visually and audially, of what Paris is sounding like in the 1920s. And so the piece again received a mixed reception on its premiere. The critics, again, weren't too happy, and as I pull out my crib notes, this was Gershwin's comment in terms of what an American Paris was like, and he says this. He says, "It's not a Beethoven symphony, you know. It's a humorous piece. There's nothing solemn about it. It's not intended to draw tears. If it pleases symphony audiences as a light, jolly piece, a series of impressions musically expressed, then it succeeds." So I think as you listen to it tonight, that will be exactly what you will hear, and you will probably find yourself transported to Paris. All right, so enjoy the concert.